She looked away only when a log collapsed heavily in the fireplace, sending up a flourish of sparks. She contemplated the fire. "Yes," she said, "the folks next door. If you are not prepared to be vilified as I have been, you must take those drab little lives as your subject, the lives of the people, of your brother. Remember this, when someone calls himself your brother, he does so with one desire, that you will become his keeper, a slave to his own incapacity and idleness. Above all, save yourselves from your brother. Now, boys, here is a question for you. What does your value derive from?" She watched us as she put another cigarette in her holder and accepted the flame from an outstretched hand. She let the silence grow. I noticed that her florid red lipstick was smeared at both corners of her mouth, and that a run in one of her stockings cut a long white scar across her knee. "Very well," she finally said. "Let me tell you what your value does not derive from. It does not derive from the self-sacrifice demanded by some party or state or from the church of some ludicrous god. It does not proceed from the people. In exchange for your reason and your freedom, they may give you a certificate of virtue, even some power. But this is worthless. It is less than worthless. It is bondage. When your power comes from others on approval, you are their slave. Never sacrifice yourselves. Never! Whoever urges you to self-sacrifice is worse than a common murderer who at least cuts your throat himself without persuading you to do it. You must revere yourselves. To revere yourself is to live truly. And as I know only too well, to live truly is to live at war. Yes, at war. With the people and the party and the guilt-peddling Jesus industry. Hear, hear, barked a man in the front row. Ayn Rand dipped her head in acknowledgement and gave a bitter smile. My heroes are impossible, they say. Unreal. And why do they say that? Because they want you to believe that heroism itself is unreal. They want you to despise yourselves before you discover what you are capable of. Boys, please. You are born to be giants, not sacrifices to some tribal deity or some idiot fantasy of earthly paradise, or some brainless slattern worrying about the next payment on the refrigerator. What the other writers present is life. Little men and little women with little worries being held hostage by snut-nosed brats. They would have you think only this is real, that you must settle for this, the worst of lies. I say that what other writers present as life is nothing more than an alibi for cowardice and treason. Treason against yourselves, against the John Galt, in each of you. I sneezed again. It had come on, strangely enough, at the mention of snot-nosed brats, and there was no stopping it. Ayn Rand stiffened visibly, but didn't look at me. Miss Rand. She turned to face the headmaster. He was standing against the back wall, arms across his chest. Miss Rand, you take a pretty dim view of your fellow writers. She stared at him as if transfixed, perhaps by the wen on his forehead, which was glowing like a coal. Finally she said, "Yes. What other view do they offer?" "Oh, good many, I think. But let me ask you this. If you had to name the single greatest work by an American author, what would it be?" Atlas shrugged. "Your own novel. Is there another? And after that? The Fountainhead. Is there really no other American writer whose work you admire? The ash on her cigarette, having grown to an improbable length, fell into her lap. She brushed it away, then glared at the gray smudge it left on her black skirt. There is one, she said. I am interested in the novels of Mr. Mickey Spillane. His metaphysic is perhaps rather instinctive, but quite sound nevertheless. Mickey Spillane, the mystery writer? I would particularly recommend I, the Jury. In Mike Hammer, he has created a true hero. One who doesn't torture himself in the current fashion with decadent niceties. Mike knows evil from good and destroys it without hesitation or regret. Most unusual. Most satisfying. I might also mention Kiss Me Deadly, though Mr. Spillane leaves us hanging somewhat at the end. What will happen with Mike and the beautiful Velda? I believe he owes us a sequel. I thought, what about Ernest Hemingway? And blurted the question in just those words. Hemingway again. Hemingway with the beard. Please. What you find in Hemingway is everything that is wrong with the so-called literature of this country. Weak premises. Weak, defeated people. A completely malevolent sense of life. Why should that nurse, what's her name, Catherine? Why should Catherine have to die at the end? No reason. Only to give the lieutenant a tragedy to excuse his self-pity. Unreadable mush. And I understand that the other novels are even worse. Indeed, I am told that one of them has a hero with no, no manhood. How fitting. And what shall we learn from this wretched eunuch to whom the great bearded Ernest Hemingway has devoted an entire novel? The superior virtue of impotence? No, thank you. At this she looked from me to the headmaster, ignoring the laughter and applause from her chorus. But it was Hiram Dufresne, who spoke next. I read that book, he said. A long time ago, but I still remember it. That's a war injury you're talking about. I don't claim to know, she said. Well, my point is, Miss Rand, you were talking about heroism here, and to my way of thinking, a war injury is more likely a sign of heroism than weakness. She shrugged. That depends. If the wound is received through an action undertaken for the happiness of the man himself, it might be heroic. If for the sake of others, a self-sacrifice, I would call it weakness. I don't know that any man is glad to die in a war. Then he should choose not to. He has a sovereign right to seek his own happiness in his own way, short of violating the rights of another man. You've read John Galt's speech, I assume? It's all there. That sounds fine, Miss Rand, but the truth is, you only get to say it because so many good men died fighting. I knew some of them. Please, you're confusing the question. The question is, what was their motive? If they died fighting for their own happiness, they have my respect. If they sacrificed themselves for mine, they died weakly, and I should add, irrationally, even immorally. If to die for the so-called public interest is good, if the public interest is the moral validation of an act, then it must also be good to bully and rob and sacrifice others for the public interest. Then you have justified the fascism of a Hitler or a Kennedy. Yes, Kennedy! Now, sir, you are an industrialist, are you not?
Mr. Dufresne was slow to answer. Though looking at her, he appeared to be lost in his own thoughts.
Yes, he said. I have a number of concerns here and abroad. I trust you do business for your own benefit, not as a public service.
Actually, Miss Rand, I do think of my work as benefiting others. It's what keeps me going.
This will sound pretty corny, but I want to give back what I've been given. I've been given a lot, as I'm sure you have.
Then you are sure of an untruth. I have been given nothing. And I have no doubt that you exaggerate your own debt, as you've been so carefully taught to do. I've always said that the only thing wrong with the American industrialist is his innocence. He has no idea what this country owes him. On the contrary, he accepts the shame forced on him by the very parasites who would suck him dry. Poor baby, he even seeks their blessing. But here,
Jen crossed her legs and drew herself erect.
Here, she said, is a true blessing for you. In the name of the individual, capitalism, and the spirit of John Galt.
And with her cigarette holder, she traced a figure in the air. A dollar sign. Hiram Dufresne started to reply, but broke off when a man in the front began clapping. His companions joined in. The skinny blonde stood, and when the applause died down, said in a trembling voice,
Miss Rand, I just want you to know that your books have completely changed my life.
As they should, dear, as they should. Ah, I see my guardian angel pointing at his watch. Is there a last question?
A boy named Jaspers had been waving his arm like a railroad switchman. But just then, Mrs. Ramsey raised her soft, southern voice from the back of the room.
We all make mistakes, she said. If this isn't too personal, Miss Rand, what was the biggest mistake you have ever made?
I reject your premise. If you act rationally, you cannot act mistakenly. And I have always acted rationally.
Jasper started to wave again, but Big Jeff was already on his feet.
Miss Rand, your books reach thousands of people.
Millions.
Millions of people. Just think what a difference it would make if they knew your position on meat.
She bent forward.
What? What is it you're saying? Just that if your readers knew you didn't eat meat, I bet a lot of them would give it up too.
Meat?
She pushed herself up from the chair.
Are you talking about meat? What depraved psychology prompts you to speak like this to the author of Atlas Shrugged?
This is our own Jeffrey Purcell, the headmaster said. As it was his story you chose, perhaps Jeffrey can be forgiven for thinking you agreed with his thesis.
Meat,
she flapped her hand in front of her face.
Enough, she said. I am quite finished.
The tall fellow came up with her cape and settled it on her shoulders as the admirers surged forward, and the rest of us stood and stretched and began putting on our coats. All of us but one. Still waving his arm, Jaspers finally cried out,
Miss Rand! Miss Rand!
The room went quiet, and she looked at Jaspers, and he asked the question he'd been dying to ask. She jerked her head back as if she'd been slapped. All the dark-dressed men and women turned on him in utter loathing, a court of ravens about to eat the eyes out of this whey-faced, homesick boy with his chewed-up fingernails and puppyish need to be in on everything, who in his need had asked Ayn Rand the very question I had been itching to ask, and probably would have asked if she hadn't skunked me for mentioning Hemingway. Who is John Galt?
Slice of Life. Who is John Galt? By a joke of fate, the question that brought poor Jaspers into such disfavor turned out to be the very first line of Atlas Shrugged, as I discovered when I borrowed the book from our library a few days after Ayn Rand's visit. I took a few runs at it, but never got past the opening chapter. And when I returned to the fountainhead, I couldn't read that either. Not anymore. The problem was that I could no longer read Ayn Rand's sentences without hearing her voice. And hearing her voice, I saw her face. To be exact, the face she'd turned on me when I sneezed. Her disgust had power. This was no girlish shudder. This was spiritual disgust. And it forced on me a vision of the poor specimen under scrutiny. Chapped lips, damp white face, rheumy eyes and all. She made me feel that to be sick was contemptible. There couldn't have been any other reason for her to despise me so. Not at that moment. Before I had offended her by mentioning Hemingway. At first I wondered if I'd mistaken her expression, but she snuffed that small doubt with the look she gave our headmaster. Her revulsion was as naked as a child's, and it continued to show itself in the cold, offended tone she used with him. It seemed that a wen was no less damnable than a runny nose, and this alone made it hard for me to read even the novel I'd been so captured by. I became touchily aware that both Rourke and Dominique looked great and never had a sick day between them. Before now, I'd taken their good looks for granted, like the ugliness of their arch-enemy, Ellsworth Toohey. It hadn't occurred to me that the author actually thought that an afflicted face was deserving of scorn. Her heroes were hardy, happily formed, and didn't have brats. In fact, there were no brats at all in the Fountainhead, or in what little I read of Atlas Shrugged. The heroic life apparently left no time for children, or domestic cares, or the exertions of ordinary sympathy. After getting pinned by her look, I couldn't imagine Ayn Rand driving 8 minutes, let alone 8 hours, to nurse a sick relative. The same went for Dominique and Rourke, who seemed to have no relatives, or even friends, only inferiors. For several weeks I'd measured other people against them, and other people had always come up short. Now I couldn't read the novel without trying to imagine the two of them changing my sour sheets, walking me to the can. No dice. They wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in that sick room. They wouldn't have shown up at all. The self-pity I felt at this betrayal dressed itself up as fierce affection for Grandjean and Patty, who had done all this for me. I found myself defending them against Dominique and Rourke, as if they, not I, had turned up their noses at these loyal, good-hearted boors. And this line of thinking led me back to my own home, which Ayn Rand would consider a perfect instance of the drab little life she'd condemned. My mother had certainly been held hostage by one snot-nosed brat. Too much of her short life had been lost to worries about lousy cars, lousy teeth, lousy refrigerators. And as for my father, his already uncertain character devastated by grief, God knows there was plenty of weakness there. That much was true. But Ayn Rand's cartoon vision of my parents, brainless slattern, frustrated imbecile, sickened me. She had no idea what went on between such beleaguered people, how infinitely complicated it was and dramatic, the effort it had taken them to keep going through all the disappointment and sickness and dreams of escape. I blamed Ayn Rand for disregarding all this,
and I no doubt blamed her even more because I had disregarded it myself. Because for years now, I had hidden my family in calculated silences and vague hints and dodges, suggesting another family in its place. The untruth of my position had given me an obscure, chronic sense of embarrassment. Yet since I hadn't outright lied, I could still blind myself to its cause. Unacknowledged shame enters the world as anger. I naturally turn mine against the snobbery of others. In the present case, Ayn Rand. This part of my reaction was personal and unreasoned, but there was more. It had dawned on me that I didn't really know anyone like Rourke or Dominique, though Ayn Rand insisted that such people existed, and that she herself was one. My own experience of them was purely literary. Everyone I knew, even in the most privileged families, was beset by unheroic worries. A brilliant daughter made pregnant by her piano teacher. A sweet-tempered son gone surly and secretive, flunking out of school and shedding his friends, and wrecking one car after another as if with a will. Nervous breakdowns and squabbles over money. I had stayed with these families during holidays and long weekends, and among even the happiest of them, I had learned to efface my presence at certain moments. The sound of a door slamming upstairs, a husband's dark silence as his wife poured herself yet another glass of wine. The people I knew, and the families I knew, were all more or less beset. And none of them, not one, seemed capable of the perfect rationality and indomitable exercise of will that Ayn Rand demanded as a condition of respect. Nor, I had to admit, was I. Everyone was troubled. Nobody measured up. And I began to think that the true failure lay in Ayn Rand's grasp of human reality. Her ridicule of Hemingway brought this home to me. Not immediately, of course. My first reaction was shock at her unfairness, not only to the writer, but to a character for whom I had a great liking. Wretched eunuch, she'd called Jake Barnes, as if the fact of such a wound, of woundedness itself, made him merely pathetic. I knew Jake pretty well, having read The Sun Also Rises twice the previous summer. He'd gotten about the worst break I could then imagine. But he wasn't wretched. He took pleasure in how Paris came to life in the morning. Pleasure in food and drink and travel. In watching men face dangerous animals. In fishing. In friendship. Jake lingered on these things. He watched the life around him with interest. You could sometimes feel the pulse of hopeless longing, but you could not say that Jake was wretched. It was wrong, and it was mean. It had become a fashion at school to draw lines between certain writers, as if to like one meant you couldn't like the other. So far, I'd avoided the practice. I liked most of what I chose to read and saw no point in reducing my pleasures by half. But Ayn Rand jolted me into taking sides. She made me feel the difference between a writer who despised woundedness and one for whom it was a bedrock fact of life. In the weeks after her visit, I reread In Our Time and all the Hemingway stories in my textbooks and anthologies. The young narrator of In Another Country has been shot in the leg, and among his crowd of patients, he's the lucky one. Manolo in The Undefeated goes straight from a hospital bed into the bullring and is almost immediately gored again. The Battler opens with Nick nursing a black eye just before he meets a punch-drunk boxer with one ear gone and the other worn to a nub. And in cross-country snow, he can't telemark because of a wound to his leg. The narrator of The Snows of Kilimanjaro is dying of gangrene. All these wounds and scars. I'd never linked them up before. But when I did, they began to seem the most visible symptoms of a general condition that included the Swede's despair, Francis Macomber's humiliation, Krebs's inability to feel. There's a moment at the end of Indian camp when Nick's father is rowing them home after delivering a baby by cesarean. It's been a rough morning. In the course of the birthing, the baby's father, unable to leave the hut because of a crippling axe wound, was driven to such distress by his woman's cries that he slashed his own throat. Nick avoided watching the operation, but had a good look at the dead man's neck when his father examined the cut. He's young. Still calls his father Daddy. Now they're crossing the lake toward home, Nick trailing his hand in the water. And what is he feeling? In the early morning, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die. I first read the end of this story with something like nostalgia. What child hasn't dreamily trailed a hand in the water, lulled by the creak of oars in stronger hands, the rhythmic lunge of the boat? This memory, more the bodies than the minds, brought with it a recollection of the old serene trust that the world was kindly and mine for good. I recalled having this trust, and so recognized what Nick was feeling, but I no longer felt it myself. It had a sting in its tail, this quiet passage. Even as I smiled at young Nick's doomed assurance, doomed the instant he insisted on it, I understood that mine was already gone, and with it, the trick of not seeing my own fate in that of others. At this moment, I knew what I knew, that what happened to everyone else would happen to me. You can't read Indian Camp and then go back to the Fountainhead. Everything seems bloated and cheesy. The swollen sentences, the hysterical partisanship of the author, the crassly symbolic, uninflected characters, the impossible things they think and say and do. Really, you can't believe a word of it. Indian Camp ruined the Fountainhead for me, even as the novel helped me to see the patience and delicacy and adamant reality of the story. I already admired Hemingway above all other writers, but the truth was that I'd been drawn to him mostly by his life, that is, by the legend of his life, and by a set of ideas about his work that spilled over from the legend. I'd gone in looking for images of toughness, self-sufficiency, freedom from the hobbles of family and class and conventional work. So that's what I'd found. Now I was reading a different writer. Hard things happened in these stories, but the people weren't hard. They felt the blows. Some of them gave up and some came back for more, but coming back wasn't easy. The first time I read Big Two-Hearted River, I liked it for its physical details. You saw everything Nick did in precise, almost fussy descriptions that most writers would have left out. How he drives the pegs of his tent until the rope loops are buried, and holds his pants and shoes in his hand when leaving the tent at sunup. How he dampens his fishing leaders. Exactly how much flour and water he uses to make his pancakes, a cup of each. I'd like being in on all these rough solemnities, but I had missed the fact that Nick observes them so carefully. Religiously is not too strong a word, because they keep him from falling apart. How had I missed that? Reading the story now, I saw everything through the shimmer of Nick's fragility. We had been taught not to confuse the writer with the work. But I couldn't separate my picture of Nick from my picture of Hemingway. And I had a sense that I wasn't really supposed to, that a certain confusion of author and character was intended. But the man who lived in these stories was not the steely warrior genius whose image had so fogged my first impressions. He was, in most respects, an unremarkable, even banal man, who got things wrong and suffered from nervousness and fear. fear even of the workings of his own mind, and who sometimes didn't know how to behave. I hated the way he dumped Marjorie in the end of something. Telling a girl who's loved you'd taken advantage of that it wasn't fun anymore? I judged him for that, thinking how much better I would have handled it. I judged him, but I also understood that he'd allowed me to, and this was chastening. Knowing that readers like me would see him and Nick, he had given us a vision of spiritual muddle and exhaustion, almost embarrassing in its intimacy. The truth of these stories didn't come as a set of theories. You felt it on the back of your neck. Well, not everyone at our school loved Hemingway. He had his critics. One of our English masters, Mr. Rice, a native of Mississippi, insisted on putting him in the ring with Faulkner. At dinner, it was sometimes his pleasure to recite the infamous love scene from For Whom the Bell Tolls, flattening his rich drawl into a deadpan that threw every fault of sentiment and phrasing into painful relief. One night I tried to return the fun with a passage from Absalom, Absalom, that I had memorized for this very purpose. Blowing my voice into a fat bubble of molasses, thus did I answer his Hemingway with my Faulkner. Talking in that grim, haggard, amazed voice, until at last listening would renege, and hearing sense self-confound, and the long-dead object of her impotent yet indomitable frustration would appear, as though by outraged recapitulation evoked, inattentive and harmless, out of the biding and dreamy and victorious dust. I was enjoying myself so hugely that I failed to notice the ice thickening on the table. But when I brought the passage home, nobody laughed. All the boys were attending fixedly to their meatloaf. Only Mr. Rice was looking at me, over the rim of his glasses. And I understood the instant I met his gaze, that but for the luck of age and circumstance, I might well find myself called out to an affair of honor. Finally, as if not trusting himself to speak to me, he turned savagely on the boy to his right and said, "You will be so good as to pass the catsup, sir." I knew there was a vein of portentousness and swagger in Hemingway. Mimicking it was good sport, even among those of us who looked up to him. But I did look up to him. Now more than ever. So much, in fact, that I began to copy out his stories. I'd read an article about a writer's colony in Marshall, Illinois, where the aspirants spent their mornings transcribing masterworks in order to learn what it actually felt like to write something great. James Jones had been associated with this group. If the practice helped him write from here to eternity, why couldn't it help me? I used my typewriter. Because Hemingway famously did, posed above it in a photo over my desk. But I slowed myself to hunt and peck speed, so I could feel the sentences take form, sense the shift in focus or tone when I struck the carriage return for a new paragraph. A thoughtful pause as I read over the page I'd just finished, and slowly rolled a fresh one into the platen. Then the final period smacking home, and all the joy of completion. The joy of Hemingway himself, as I rolled out the last sheet of The Undefeated, laid it upon the others, and squared the stack. None of this seemed ridiculous to me. A friend's parents back home had learned complicated dances by following footprints on diagrams they rolled out on the floor. I'd seen them do the mambo very impressively at a Christmas party. And they sure as hell weren't using their scrolls. They weren't even watching their feet. They were just doing what came naturally. From instincts they had trained with certain devotions. And the result was invention. Freedom. Mambo. I had written
Indian Camp, and The Undefeated, and had just begun The Killers when the headmaster remained standing after the dinner blessing one night and announced that Ernest Hemingway had agreed to be the next visiting writer. He would be with us in the middle of May, some 6 weeks hence. The headmaster watched us, enjoying the shock he'd produced. I glanced over at Dean Makepeace. He had to be behind this visit. Other boys were looking at him, too. He was bent forward in his chair, studying the tablecloth. Then someone yelled, "Bravo!" and the room went nuts. Whistles, shouts, feet drumming the floor, fists pounding the tables. It started to die down, then flared up again. None of the masters tried to stop it. They couldn't have. It was about Hemingway, sure. But it was also about the sap starting to run after the first warm week since Thanksgiving. But mostly it was about Hemingway. And at that moment, sitting in the dining hall surrounded by cheering boys, I felt quite sure my story would win. The Forked Tongue. That was the sweetest spring of all my years there. An early shock of heat forced the leaves and blossoms to a lushness that came to seem downright tropical. When the chemistry master's parrot escaped into an elm overlooking the quad, there he preened his bright feathers and stridently mocked us until starvation humbled him to earth, where he sold his freedom for a groundsman's peanut butter sandwich. The sudden departure of Roberta Ramsey darkened the campus for a few days. She simply vanished, and Mr. Ramsey's gloom was all the explanation we had. But the sap was running, and for the rest of us, the shadow passed. Mr. Ramsey had once told us about a riot of boys at his old school, Winchester, back in 1793, that finally had to be put down by a regiment of dragoons. In pale midwinter, with each of us hunched over his own faint ember, while the latest blizzard howled at the windows, this story had seemed remote and improbable. Not now. We were all a little drunk with spring, like the fat bees reeling from flower to flower, and a strange insurrectionary current ran among us. This went beyond the usual swagger of bloods about to graduate. Even small fry still in beanies started showing up late to class, went sockless in their loafers, forgot to say, "Sir," and then paused a near defiant beat when invited to correct themselves. The masters chose to regard most of these provocations as trivial, even ludicrous, like the grousing of impotent peasants outside the castle walls. They felt the season, too. It softened them. And the last thing they wanted was to throw out a boy from my class, so close to the finish line. We really had to force their hand. And we did. 3 times. It wasn't mutiny that caused the first expulsion. You might say it was the opposite, excess of devotion. When our glee club went to Boston to sing at an alumni dinner, a boy named Keyes filched a bottle of champagne and got sloppy maudlin drunk on the bus ride back to school. Some of the other choristers, myself among them, managed to hustle him up to his room undetected. But once there, we couldn't keep him quiet. He was bawling the school songs, hanging all over us and telling us what great guys we were and how we should start some kind of club together. The hallmaster took his time in coming. When he finally showed up, he simply tapped on the door and told us to call it a night. He obviously didn't want to see anything that would make him take action. Then Keyes broke loose and crashed into the hallway and threw his arms around the master, slobbering school spirit. Other boys came out of their rooms to see what was going on. The master gazed at us from Keyes's embrace. You could tell how sad he looked, how resigned, that Keyes was a goner. Then Jack Broom, handsome Jack himself, backfield Jack, captain of everything,
got bounced for hitchhiking down to Miss Cobb's academy one night to meet a girl. When they caught them in the boathouse there, it was curtains for her, and our headmaster could do no less. Not long after this, my friend Purcell began to cut daily chapel. He simply, steadfastly, would not go, and I was only one of many who tried to get him to relent before they had to kick him out. Purcell refused. He said that God was just a character in a Hebrew novel, and if it came to that, he'd rather worship Huckleberry Finn. "Really," he said, "I don't believe a word of that stuff." "You don't have to." "You don't have to, maybe. It's what, 15 minutes a day? Doesn't have to mean anything you don't want it to mean. Think your own thoughts. What's the harm in that?" "Just going through the door makes me a liar," Purcell said. "I'm not going to do it again." He meant what he said. I kept my counsel when I saw the pleasure Purcell took in rejecting it. Saw that it made him feel honorable in comparison to me. We were allowed a fair number of cuts, but by the end of April he'd used his up, and the demerit meter was ticking. The rest of us looked on with a murmurous show of dread as his tally climbed toward the sudden death number, and told one another how much we admired him for sticking to his guns. And I did somewhat, though my admiration was muddied by Purcell's taking the high road with me, as if my going to chapel was nothing but show. The truth was that I looked forward to the moment each day when I passed through that limestone arch he so abhorred. We were loud boys, forever bellowing and jeering, yet we all knew to shut up when we entered the chapel. You felt the hush there as a profound agreement, an act of 300 wills, and that made it even deeper and more calming. The chaplain always did a short reading and led us in a couple of hymns. But we were otherwise left to the silence in the dark wood, the glowing windows, and rough stone and dim vaulted spaces overhead. Purcell ridiculed even the architecture. Episcopalian English envy, he called it, which irritated me. I didn't like to wonder if my responsiveness was only another kind of snobbery. But it was Purcell's crack about the Hebrew novel that really rubbed me wrong. Not the glib irreverence, but the way he said Hebrew. It came to me as a rank, dismal breath from some deep well of genteel disdain. Purcell didn't mean it like that, and he would have hated the notion of speaking with the unconscious voice of his class. That made it all the worse. It was so unconscious and therefore incorrigible an assertion of class that it made me feel a kind of despair. I wanted to say, "Don't you know who you're talking to?" But of course he didn't know. I'd made sure of that. As the days passed, I came to see the drama of his refusal as another display of blood-borne assurance. It mattered very much to me that I graduate, whereas it didn't really matter to Purcell. A diploma from the school would open no doors to him that weren't already open, just because he was his father's son. He wouldn't even lose his place at Yale. Unless you get kicked out for an honor code violation, you could still take final exams at the end of the year, and the school would certify that you had met its academic requirements. What Purcell would actually lose then, or renounce, was the chance to end this span of years in shared life with the rest of us. To sit with us on the graduation platform and feel silly in his mortarboard cap and mutter dark footnotes during the As You Go Forth speech. Then to mingle on the quad with our proud families, drifting from group to group, shaking hands, putting on his best manners with those most obviously not of his world. To doctor his punch from a friend's flask, but only once, not wanting to dull himself to the unexpected full-heartedness he feels. To linger as the shadows spill across the grass and day turns to dusk. Even to lend his raspy voice to the songs being raised by boys still not ready to say goodbye to each other. To look into their faces, some dear, some not, all of them familiar as his own. And allow himself a moment's blindness as our last song dies away. I'm sure I was not alone in having imagined this day ever since I came to the school. But Purcell could give it up without a backward glance, because to him the years now closing were a story of no importance, if a story at all. He instinctively saw himself as belonging to a narrative so grand that this part of it counted only as transitional material. So I suspected. Or to put it another way, I suspected that his willingness to be expelled was less a proof of principle than a sort of colossal snub. And there was something else. Purcell had begun to absent himself from chapel as the stir over Hemingway's visit grew more and more feverish. The English masters were all teaching his work. The art master had produced a striking poster, the famous face suggested by a few black strokes over the line, "One must, above all, endure," that stared out from every bulletin board and entryway. Knowing that the greatest of living writers would soon be among us made us a little crazy with self-importance. Nor was it just the literary boys who got worked up. It seemed like most of the class planned to enter a story. As Picasso and Ted Williams knew Hemingway, as Kennedy knew Hemingway, one of us would soon know Hemingway, and so be raised to that company. Purcell loved Hemingway's work. He surely wanted that private audience as much as anybody, but I knew he hated the idea of competing for it. So did I. Only one of the many could be chosen. We all understood that. Yet you couldn't help feeling that not to be chosen was to be rejected. And to be rejected by Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway tossing your story aside. No, not him, not a prayer. What a terrible thought. If being chosen was a blessing, and how else could you see it? Then to be rejected was a curse. Well, that's how the logic worked for me. I assumed it worked the same way for Purcell, whose vanity was at least as wary of rebuke as my own. Submissions were due the first Monday in May, 2 weeks before Hemingway's visit. If Purcell kept cutting chapel, his demerits would send him home on the preceding Saturday. He'd lose his chance for the audience, but spare himself the indignity of jostling with the herd and quite possibly losing. Yet in the very act of retreat, he would seem a hero, the boy who would not falsely bend his knee. His expulsion would pass into legend. I never thought Purcell had planned any of this, or that he was aware of any fault line under his resolve. He no doubt took his motives at face value. I didn't. That was all. But I might have been wrong. If I was wrong, supposing so much doubleness in Purcell, it was probably because I saw so much in myself. I should have been rejoicing. I'd been awarded a full scholarship to Columbia University to work with Lionel Trilling, as I like to think and often told myself. An essay I'd written on Shakespeare's Sonnet No. 29. When in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes, had just won the Cassidy English Prize, a great stroke of luck. 5 weeks at a summer program in Oxford, all expenses paid. My classmates liked me, most of them, and a few of the younger boys paid me a kind of puppyish attention that I recognized from my own early days, when some upperclassmen caught my eye. And why would I catch a new boy's eye? Maybe because, from my own anxious studies, I had made myself the picture of careless gentility, ironically cordial when not distracted. Hair precisely unkempt, shoes down at heel, clothes rumpled and frayed to perfection. This was the sort of figure I'd been drawn to almost from the beginning. It had somehow suggested sailing expertise, Christmas in St. Anton, inherited box seats, and an easy disregard for all that. By going straight to the disregard, I'd hoped to imply the rest. I had also meant to wipe out any trace of the public school virtues, sharpness of dress, keenness of manner, spanking cleanliness, freshness, niceness, sincerity,
I used to cultivate. By now I'd been absorbed so far into my performance that nothing else came naturally. But I never quite forgot that I was performing. In the first couple of years, there'd been some spirit of play in creating the part, refining it, watching it pass. There'd been pleasure in implying a personal history through purely dramatic effects of manner and speech, without ever committing an expository lie, and pleasure in doubleness itself. There was more to me than people knew. All that was gone. When I caught myself in the act now, I felt embarrassed. It seemed a stale, conventional role, and 4 years of it had left me a stranger, even to those I called my friends. I wanted out. That was partly why I'd chosen Columbia. I liked how the city seethed up against the school, mocking its theoretical seclusion with hustle and noise, the din of people going and getting and making. Things that mattered at Princeton or Yale couldn't possibly withstand this battering of raw, unironic life. You didn't go to eating clubs at Columbia. You went to jazz clubs. You had a girlfriend. No, a lover. With psychiatric problems and friends with foreign accents. You read newspapers on the subway and looked at tourists with a cool anthropological gaze. You said, Crosstown Express. You said, The Village. You ate weird food. No other boy in my class would be going there. It wasn't exactly true that I told no expository lies. Most of my own stories had been meant to seem autobiographical, and thus to give a false picture of my family and my life at home, of who I was. I'd allowed myself to do this by thinking that, after all, they were just stories. But they weren't really stories. Not like Big Two-Hearted River was a story, or Soldier's Home. It struck me that Hemingway's willingness to let himself be seen as he was, in uncertainty or meanness or fear, even empty of feelings, somehow gave the charge of truth to everything else. My stories were designed to make me appear as I was not. They were props in an act. I couldn't read any of them without thrusting the pages away in mortification. I couldn't write like that again, but didn't know how else to write. How to go about making something that was true? I was frozen. For the simple relief of putting words on paper, I continued to type out Hemingway's stories, slowly, meditatively, a page or so a day. I had the hope that something here would send me off on a story of my own. No luck so far, but I kept at it, page after page. Krebs acquired the nausea in regard to experience that is the result of untruth or exaggeration. In this way, he lost everything. I knew just how Krebs felt. Everybody else was writing up a storm. As one of the top scholars in our class, Bill had been awarded a private study in the basement of the library. He worked there, so I didn't see much of him. But when I did, he was thoughtful and tense. I had trouble getting a smile out of him. If I succeeded, I felt a gratitude I found myself resenting. He told me he had a story in the works, and that was all he'd admit to. The unboyish sadness I'd seen in Bill that winter had darkened. He seemed lost in the contemplation of something doleful, even tragic, that I could only suppose was finding its way into his new work. Purcell had a story going as well, with not entirely charming matter-of-factness. He told me it was the best thing he'd ever written, and professed to be astonished at the ease of its writing. I didn't see any mystery here. If he kept cutting chapel, he'd never have to expose his story to judgment, and it was at least partly the prospect of judgment that had me all in knots. George Kellogg decided to submit a new version of a story we'd run in Troubadour that winter, an account of a man bullying his wife at the dinner table while their son eats his veal cutlet and doesn't say a word. No boy had ever won two audiences.
Well, there wasn't any rule against it, but I thought it was pretty damned piggish of George to try to snag Hemingway after landing Frost. Just knowing he was in the race became a vexation, and it got worse when I went to his room to ask about the manuscripts for the next issue of the review. George hadn't been passing them around. He answered when I knocked, though for once his good manners deserted him, and he kept typing away on his massive old black Underwood, while I stood just inside the door. The machine looked as big as an organ. It made a deep, emphatic, methodical sound. The blinds were drawn, the windows closed, and the air felt swampy. I could hear the muffled